Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find a Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com. So, Shopify, I've got a stock for you, Shopify, Lisa. The stock is up 215% over the last year. These are the good folks that help merchants set up and manage their online stores. Stock has done phenomenally well. Just had some great earnings out in the last couple of days. Harley Finkelstein, Chief Operating Officer of Shopify, joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Harley, thanks so much for being with us. Usually we chat with you on the phone, so it's good to have you in studio.
Great to be here.
What is driving the growth of Shopify? I mean, when people think online, they think Amazon putting retail out of business. But there are a lot of retailers using your technology that are kind of getting it done, right?
Yeah, there's a million stores now on Shopify, and they sold $61 billion in 2019. That's up about 49% from the previous year. Our revenue for 2019 was approximately $1.5 billion. That's up 47%. So certainly, I think people are beginning to understand what Shopify is. And what we are is we're the world's first retail operating system, and we have stores that are starting on Shopify getting really big. That's the Allbirds, that's the Bombas socks of the world, that's the Gymsharks of the world. They're becoming category leaders. But also, we also have big brands. I mentioned KitchenAid and PepsiCo and P&G that are also moving over to
us. So they use your guys' platform as opposed to building it out of themselves? Is that kind of the way you think about
it? Yeah, some of them built these homegrown stores and decided they don't want to run massive engineering teams. In other cases, they're migrating over from the large enterprise offerings.
So if you look at a chart of your stock, since the end of 2018, it's just gone stratospheric, right? I mean, it's just absolutely rocketed. And I'm trying to understand how you maintain this sort of momentum at a time when there is a lot of competition and at a time when there still are a lot of questions about the economy.
Yeah, so a couple things. First of all, I think when we first went public, which was 2015, Shopify was really an e-commerce provider for merchants and entrepreneurs and small businesses in the English-speaking world. Since then, we've expanded well beyond e-commerce. We now power physical retail across, if you walk in any Albert store, you'll see Shopify powering the physical locations. And we do that across thousands of brick and mortar stores. We have a capital business. We've given out more than $800 million in cash advances. We have a payments business. We're launching a fulfillments business now. And we've also expanded beyond just our core geographies. In fact, we've grown the amount of merchants on our platform outside English-speaking countries from 24% last year to 29% this past quarter. And so we're seeing a larger TAM, and we're doing more for our merchants, which is why I sort of refer to us as this retail operating system, not just an e-commerce provider anymore.
So, you know, as an e-commerce provider or it expanded larger, you guys did not come out of Silicon Valley, did you? You guys are in Ottawa.
We are, absolutely.
Talk to us about like the startup community, the startup vibe in Canada. Is Ottawa the place to do it, or is it just entrepreneurs kind of all over?
Yeah, actually, I think startups and entrepreneurship and technology has become geographically agnostic.
Yep.
I actually think it's an advantage to be outside of Silicon Valley. I have a lot of peers that run companies like ours in the Valley, and they tell me that the average tenure of employees there is super short, like 18 months. We see incredible talent coming out of Canada. We see incredible loyalty. And I think there's something to be said about being the best place to work in any single geography. And I think Shopify is the best place to work in Canada and one of them around the world.
What about competition? I imagine that Amazon would love to get a piece of what you're doing.
Yeah. So we don't compete with Amazon. Our million merchants do. And I think what Amazon is doing is they're trying to build an empire. And what we're doing is we're arming the rebels, and the rebels are winning. So you see companies like Nike moving off Amazon because they want to have a direct relationship with their end consumers. Allbirds, for example, if you try to buy Allbirds on Amazon, you can only find fake Allbirds, and Allbirds has been built on Shopify.
So basically the idea here is, rather than go to Amazon, you're trying to give them tools to be able to do it themselves and create a platform. How do you offer them the same kind of visibility that they may get in an Amazon?
Yeah, so certainly if they're going to put their products on a marketplace like Amazon or eBay, they're going to they're going to rent their customers to those brands. We actually created a platform where our merchants, our brands, can actually find their own customers and own them, whether it's through social media, or you can buy marketing directly from Shopify on things like Google or Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram. And so rather than simply giving them customers or renting them the way Amazon does, and eventually they can take them back, we actually empower these merchants to create their own customer bases and then connect directly with them.
Where are you guys investing in 2020?
Heavily in SFN, Shopify Fulfillment Network. We think that is, if you sort of look at what we've been doing over the last couple of years, we're ticking off all the different challenges that a small business or a big business may have. We think fulfillment is one of those things. People don't want to use third-party logistics companies because either the requirements, the minimums are way too high, or they put everything in the same box with the marketplace's logo on it. What we're doing is we're creating this network of third-party warehouses. We're aggregating them using technology and software. We bought a company in Boston called Six River Systems last year for about $450 million. They're going to provide incredible robotic technology to make all warehouses a lot more effective. And then we're going to democratize the fulfillment network the way we've done with e-commerce.
Just real quick here, I'm wondering, what's the most effective platform for advertising that you found?
It really depends. I think for a lot of these DTC brands, the ones that are, you know, new direct-to-consumer mattress companies or companies like that, honestly, social media seems to be the best one. Now, that being said, others are in more of these traditional industries. Their TV is actually working really well for them.
Interesting.
Harley, real quickly, Elon Musk is taking advantage of his surging share price to sell some stock. Are you guys interested in selling stock?
Not at this moment.
Okay.
Harley Finkelstein, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks,
Harley Finkelstein, Chief Operating Officer of Shopify, based in Ottawa, joining us here in our Interactive Broker Studios.
Well, the global travel industry is really at the forefront of feeling the brunt of the coronavirus. You know, I'm thinking cruise ships, hotels, casinos, really seeing business impacted significantly in the shares of those companies reflecting it as well. Our next guest has a equally cautious view of those sectors. Tuna Amobi, he's a director and industry research analyst at CFRA Research. He joins us on the phone. Tuna, thanks so much for joining us again. I know you've become more cautious, downgraded a bunch of stocks. Tell us how you see kind of some of these casino companies, cruise lines, and the like.
Good morning, Paul, my friend, and thanks for having me. So over the past 2 weeks or so, we have actually taken a more dire assessment of the potential impact of the coronavirus on, the overall tourism. And, cruise ships, the online travel companies, the casinos, the one constant theme has emerged is that, while it's very difficult to quantify the overall impact, and of course, no one really knows the duration or how long it's going to last, but we think that it's starting to take a toll right now. And you just heard about, the higher number of death tolls, as well as more cases being diagnosed. So my sense is, the market may still be underestimating the potential impact of this. If you remember, I think it seems to be some comfort level that if you compare it to the SARS or the Ebola, and while those cases were ultimately, resolved, limiting its impact, what worries us here is really the speed and severity of the new cases that are being diagnosed and the death toll, which kind of leads us to believe that this is going to continue to be an overhang as the year goes on for quite some time.
Tuna, it's so interesting to hear you speak because we speak with economists and investors who say they're expecting some sort of V-shaped recovery in the economy of China and beyond. And I'm wondering, as you look at MGM basically withdrawing their entire outlook for the year, citing the disruption from the coronavirus, the fact that they get 27% of their business from Macau and are losing an estimated more than $1 million a day based on the current shutdown that we're seeing. How can we even be so sure that a place like MGM could compensate for this later on?
Yeah, we can be. That's the short answer. We actually are taking a more negative view of MDM downgrading to a sell ahead of their earnings report last night. I think that just confirmed to us that, you know, no one really has a handle of this. So they talk about the expense burn rate about $1.5 million on a daily basis, even while the casinos have been shut down, mostly for payroll. And that was also a theme that we heard from Wynn Resorts in Las Vegas. So I think you're really starting to see, you know, the casinos starting to feel the brunt of this. And remember, you know, these are, you know, this is an industry that was already massively impacted by the Hong Kong protests. So this latest coronavirus issue just seems to be adding salt to injury, and really no one has a handle on when this is going to dissipate. Now, one more thing I'd add is that even when the situation is resolved, typically from a historical perspective, we usually see several months before things can get any semblance of normalization, which is really why we think this 2020, at least the first half, certainly is going to need much more caution.
Tuna, this is definitely specific to the casino industry, the travel industries. Is there, though, a broader brush that we could paint in terms of the potential longer-term impact, given your experience examining the corporate balance sheets of these companies as well as the likes of Amazon and Netflix?
Well, you know, the one thing that I'd say is that China overall, you know, most of these companies, you talk about Amazon and Netflix, have a relatively limited direct exposure in China, partly due to the regulatory environment there. But I think the what I see is some type of tangential fallout from this geopolitical situation. A lot of these companies, even when they are not directly operating in China, have some type of strategic partnership. That's true certainly for online travel companies. And of course, casinos have a huge stake in there. So every industry is different. China itself has been a major, driver of global tourism, outbound travel. And I think what's important to remember is that while most of the issues right now appear to be limited to China, they could be, in fact, a broader geopolitical impact across even the U.S. and other, markets like Europe. Of course, that depends on how fast those cases travel. But overall, while the overall impact on GDP growth is relatively muted at this point, I think you could actually see that situation get out of control pretty fast.
So, Tuna, just on the cruise lines here, I know when you talk to a lot of people about, you know, why don't you go on a cruise? One of the concerns is just being, you know, stuck with so many people in a confined area. And it just seems like, you know, these outbreaks of diseases are perhaps more common there. Do you think there's longer term risk to kind of just the whole market, total market size for the cruising industry from this?
I think what's interesting is before this coronavirus outbreak, the cruise industry fundamentals were pretty healthy. We were expecting a near record year based on advanced indicators of booking and pricing, onboard spending. All of those indicators seem to be holding up well. Now, it seems like all bets are off. When you kind of hear stories about, you know, the Diamond Princess being quarantined and several other ships unable to find landing ports or destinations, my sense is that there is a certain amount of wariness out there among potential cruise passengers in terms of booking pending the resolution of this issue. So I think you're starting to see the guidance from cruise companies. At risk is actually why we took a more negative stance on Royal Caribbean as well as Norwegian Cruise, both of which we downgraded. We also have a sale on Carnival. So this is something that's going to hover over the industry until any more visibility in terms of the potential resolution.
Tuna, just real quick here, 30 seconds. Do you buy this argument that Netflix is getting a huge boost from this because people are sitting home and doing Netflix and chill rather than going out, potentially getting coronavirus?
Lisa, that's something we've heard before, but I'd say it's a little bit far-fetched at this point. It's really hard to kind of connect those dots. That being said, I mean, I can understand why you know, maybe in isolated cases that could be true, but hard to generalize here.
Tuna Amobi, thank you so much. Tuna Amobi, director and industry analyst at CFRA Research, joining us on the phone from New Jersey. I love that. I read a bunch of stories about how Netflix, you know, we talk about the negative impact of the coronavirus, but there are companies benefiting because people are staying home and they got to do something, so they might as well watch movies.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
On Monday, the Department of Justice announced charges against four members of China's People's Liberation Army for the 2017 hack of Equifax. And this was something that exposed millions of Americans and their private data. It raises questions, putting aside this particular case, it raises questions about just how well we are able to detect the attacks that our data is exposed to every single day. Joining us here in studio, Steve Wagner, Global Managing Director of Decision Analytics for Experian. Steve, so glad to have you. I want to start with that. Where are we when it comes to detection, when it comes to these attacks?
Sure. Well, the particular angle that we tend to come at this from in my business is really fraud and identity within commercial transactions. So a lot of ways you could answer your question, we're focused on that particular angle. I think when we think about it, and we just released a study that we've done at 6,500 consumers and 650 businesses in 13 countries around the world. And we've been looking at this question of how businesses should sort of shape their understanding. How do they react? What do they do? So the big issue is businesses faced with those kind of security threats instinctively sometimes will just clamp down, right? The best thing for me to do is to not be involved digitally with anybody. Of course, that doesn't really allow you to do business very much. So the business person the business person really has to think through what's the right way to do that, what's the right way to make commerce work. So what our business people are generally thinking about is, how do I create an extraordinary digital experience for my consumers? That's what they want to do, right? What we found in this particular study was that 95% of businesses believe that they're actually doing a good job of identifying who's coming to them electronically. 55% of consumers believe that the businesses actually understand who they are, which is obviously a significant mismatch.
So do you think the businesses that think 95% of the businesses think they're doing a good job identifying who their customers are, is that kind of false sense of security there? Do you think that is a really valid number?
Well, I think the number's valid in the study, but what you have to get to in order to understand that mismatch is the way businesses are looking at it today versus the way consumers are looking at it. So the way when you talk to a consumer, what do they care about first and foremost in their digital interactions? They care about security. So actually, when you talk to a consumer, you're a business, you're dealing with them online, indicia of security make them feel better, make them happier to interact with you. A business, on the other hand, when you rank their priorities, number one in their priority list is creating an experience that is targeted to that individual, right? So in other words, they'll look at it, they'll say, yeah, I understand. I know who Paul is. I've seen him before. That's all I need to know. Now the real question is whether or not the things I say to Paul and what I do with Paul is really on target or not. And the consumer's just saying, hey, look, actually, when you ask me for passwords and you ask me, put me into a credentialed environment, that's when I'm willing to share. So
Yeah. But this goes really to the heart of, do you know who you're dealing with? Do you know what the incoming attention you're getting really is about? According to the same study, you talked about how fraud continues to increase, with 57% of businesses citing an increase in the past 12 months. And I just wonder how much this is an increase in the ability to detect some of these, and how much is an increase in attacks, or is it both?
Yeah, so I think there's an opportunity in the market right now, because I think what we've identified, this mismatch between how consumers feel and where businesses are. Businesses also believe that if they really understand who the consumer is, fraud will go down. So it's sort of, it's clear in the study that businesses aren't quite getting it right yet. So what businesses need to do is take more advantage of the data and the analytics that are available within these online digital environments. So right now, I don't think they do that enough. They tend to say, all right, I've gotten passwords for this individual. I know their name. I know a few. I know them. But actually, there's quite a bit more available. And in particular, there are quite a few individual threat modality fraud tools that you can use. And the question is, are these being knitted together into a comprehensive way, or are businesses just employing, I use device ID. I use behavioral biometrics. I use this. When in fact, what you really need to win today is you need a comprehensive capability that incorporates sort of all of the different tools that are available, layers that with analytics so that you can really construct strong defenses.
Steve Widener, thanks so much for joining us. Really fascinating the discussion as more and more of our time is spent online. You have to balance does the business know me, and are they protecting my data, and all those
types
of things.
It's such an interesting concept that, you know, there's one thing about having artificial intelligence detecting all of the incoming threats. It's another thing just to know who you're dealing with at any given time, and how do you do that well? And that sort of dual approach to trying to stave off some of the attacks that seem to be increasing for every business that operates in the online world, which is everyone.
Steve Widener, Global Managing Director, Experian Decision Analytics, based in Orange County, California, but joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
Tesla really in the front and focus today, with shares up 1.6%. This is amazing, because ahead of the open, we saw shares down as much as 7.2%. And this comes after a filing showing that they planned a $2 billion offering of common stock, taking advantage of the rally in the share price that we've seen that's been absolutely astronomical. I'm trying to understand, A, why people don't seem to care that they're going to be diluted very, very marginally, but typically this is something that matters. And B, why then Tesla didn't raise more? Kevin Tynan joining us here in our Interactive Broker Studios. Kevin Tynan, Senior Autos Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Kevin, let's just first talk about the response. Why are shares up today?
Well, because I think the idea of adding capital to the balance sheet wasn't an overhang, right? I think that the investors believe that they are, he said this in the middle of 2018, they're going to be profitable from here forward. They're going to fund themselves from here forward. So I think that removed the bear case, or that bear argument at that time. So needing a little bit of capital here, it's not that big a deal to sort of reverse, especially when you think of the circumstances, right? It's a no-brainer considering the way the stock has run and the amount of it's absolutely the right thing to do. And to your point, I would say, why not do even more than that? But a lot of the way this company is managed is about that perception, right? Just the idea of burning short sellers, right, is just something you don't really see from most CEOs, right? You run the business the right way, profitably, growth, and that takes care of itself. To actively sort of target that group is just, it's just unorthodox. And I think that's a big part of it, is that perception, that raising capital shows a sign of weakness, that we can't fund ourselves, when in fact it's just part of the process, and when it makes sense to do so, you do it.
So the company also announced that they're going to spend about $3.5 billion in CapEx this year. Give us this, is that enough for some of the plans they've announced?
It is, because of he loves leverage, and really in this environment, who doesn't?
Right.
So a lot of that fixed investment will come from borrowing. Like, so even the Shanghai factory was money taken down from the Chinese government, and same thing probably with Berlin. So that CapEx number that they put out there probably does not include anything they would borrow to build those factories or to expand out and get to some level of scale in China, whether that's distribution infrastructure or sales infrastructure. All that stuff will come out of that CapEx number, but the buildings themselves will come from the borrowing.
Elon Musk has said that they were not going to be raising more capital this year, so this is an about face for him. Also, Tesla has been cutting back its expenditures over the past few years in response to criticism about burning through cash, and they reported an actual net profit, which is one of the reasons why shares rallied so much. Given that, and given that they seem to be doubling down on the spending and not necessarily the cash generation, why are investors so sanguine about this move?
Well, I think also too, keep in mind the projects that he's teased, right? So there's Roadster 2.0, there's semi truck, there's Cybertruck, there's Model Y coming, there's all these grand plans, there's robotaxi fleet, 1 million units in 2020. So investors, the reaction will be like, he's funding the growth. Right, there's enough things to do. There's factories to build. There's products to put out there. That this is what you have to do. You need capital to do it, and that's what he's doing.
Real quick, what's the demand for electric vehicles? Do we have a sense?
Boy, you know, it's in the 1% range in 2019. So,
what do the bulls think it will be?
Well, if you ask the Uber bulls, it's going to be that everybody who owns a car will have to have an electric vehicle. Plus, it's not only a vehicle, right? It's your smartphone. It's everything. So Tesla, as a technology company, can be all things. Everybody who needs a car and a phone is their addressable market.
Kevin Tynan, senior autos analyst, Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Tesla stock up just, you know, about 1.5% here, but that back on the news of a $2.3 billion stock offering and the associated dilution in supply into the marketplace, just extraordinary that the stock's trading up. But, you know, as Kevin was mentioning, there is a lot of capital demand for this company.
And there's a cult of belief behind Elon Musk. And I think there are other companies that if they suddenly decided to invest money in some questionable project, people wouldn't rally behind them. Elon Musk is a different case.
It's a different case. It is a cult stock for many. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.